In 1993, more than one in four American children lived in poverty. Not having enough to meet basic needs is bad for people no matter when it happens, but it's especially detrimental to kids. It can set them up for a lifetime of hardship. We all know this. What most of us don't know, by 2019, that rate had declined. So just over one in 10 U.S. kids were poor. We still have work to do, but we also have something enormous to celebrate. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We could have been celebrating all along as an increasing percentage of children had what they needed. But until my guest's recent article made it a banner headline in the New York Times, this amazing good news story had gone largely unreported. Jason DeParle is senior writer at the Times, and that article was titled "Expanded Safety Net Drives Sharp Drop in Child Poverty," followed by one the next day called "Pandemic Aid Cut U.S. Poverty to New Low in 2021." Jason, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Before we get into the numbers, we should start with this. Many of us find childhood poverty unacceptable just because we can't bear to think of children suffering. But growing up poor really does seem to create risk of all kinds of bad outcomes in adult life as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I thought you put it well in your introduction. Child poverty is, of course, a moral problem, but it's also a practical problem, as the past generation of brain science has helped teach us that early childhood experiences set children on a trajectory that can be seen in things as different as adult health, adult earnings, education levels. You know, what happens early stays with a child, and poverty in particular can leave a lifelong deficit.
I know this answer will get a little complicated, but how is poverty defined in the United States?
Well, it's defined by the government, and the government started in 2009 to publish a second poverty measure because of problems with the first one. Two obvious problems with the poverty measure as the historical one, as originally defined in the 1960s, was it didn't take into account geographic differences in cost of living, and it didn't take into account most taxes and government benefits. So starting in 2009, the government published a more refined version of the poverty measure. In more practical terms that your audience might be able to relate to, for a family of four in a typical place, the poverty line is about $29,000 a year. If you make less than that, you are in poverty. If you make more, officially, you are not.
So this newer accounting is called the Supplemental Poverty Measure. And if I have this correct, we think of people receiving certain kinds of government services as poor by definition, but it's possible for those services to actually scoop them up out of poverty, so they're living above the poverty
line. Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Sorry. Yes,
glad you jumped in. Go ahead.
Well, what we found in our analysis was that in 2019, government benefits reduced the number of children who otherwise would have been poor by about 6.5 million. So it lifted about 6.5 million children out of poverty. That could be programs as different as tax credits for working parents, like the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit. It could be SNAP, or what used to be called food stamps. That includes Social Security and disability benefits. There's all school meals. There's all different sorts of government aid, without which another 6.5 million kids would be poor.
What is the difference between poverty and what's called deep poverty for children? What necessities might a child in deep poverty be living without?
Deep poverty is defined as living on less than half the income you need to escape poverty. So if the poverty line is roughly $29,000 or so for a family of four, depending where you live, you know, then you're talking about living on less than $14,000 or $15,000 a year. If you're living on that little money, you're almost guaranteed to be facing significant hardships in your housing, where you live, the quality of your housing, whether you have secure housing, and you're much more likely to be facing food insecurity.
So had we seen changes in the rates of children living in deep poverty as of 2019 as well?
Over the past generation, it's fallen by about as much
Wow.
as regular poverty. Both have fallen. So it's not the case that children, the relatively better off part of the poverty population has gotten better, and those at the very bottom have gotten worse. I think all have gotten better.
And as of 2019,
Chris, I can, if I
please
could just
continue.
jump in and say, there's still 8 million kids in poverty in the United States, so that's a lot of poor kids. I don't want to pretend that we've, eliminated poverty in the United States. And the poverty line is an artificially drawn measure. If you have a dollar more, you're not poor. If you have a dollar less, you are poor. So just getting above the poverty measure doesn't mean you're not experiencing hardship. There's lots of low-income families that still experience lots of economic hardship, even though they are poor. Nonetheless, that said, those qualifications offered, cutting child poverty by 60% over a course of a generation is a big achievement.
Why hasn't this been shouted from the rooftops?
I think there's a little bit of statistical confusion, as we were getting into just a minute ago. There, the government now publishes two sets of poverty data, and the full impact of poverty decline is only available in one. So that's part of the answer. I think another part of the answer is that it accelerated in recent years. So this wasn't fully visible really until about 2019. Poverty fell by about another third from 2015, 16 or so to 2019. So it fell a lot in the 90s, it plateaued, and then it fell again in the late teens. And I think it's that second part of the story that is too recent to have fully been acknowledged.
And there were also gains made, reductions in poverty in 2020 and 21, but some of those gains may have been temporary. Is that right?
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. So in our analysis, we tried to look at pre-pandemic poverty, because the pandemic is such an extraordinary event, both in terms of the way in which it disrupted the economy, and because of the extra aid that the government provided, made it unrepresentative of our economy, unrepresentative of our safety net. So we looked only at 2019, but counterintuitively, when we went, poverty actually fell during the pandemic. When the pandemic started, I, among many others, assumed that poverty would rise, but the government passed three rounds of stimulus checks, expanded the child tax credit, expanded unemployment benefits. So low-income families got lots of extraordinary one-time help during the pandemic that cut child poverty even further.
Okay, so we may come back to what happened in 2020 and 21, but for now we're going to limit our discussion to the years between 93 and 2019. I think, Jason, all of us have maybe wished for a kind of silver bullet to solve these problems. Turns out what worked here was a confluence of factors. That phrase safety net is really appropriate here, isn't it?
Well, even before, so safe, when we talk about safety net, we're talking about government aid. But even before you get to government aid, there's lots of things that can lift children out of and families out of poverty. A stronger economy with more widely shared wage gains can reduce poverty. And that was part of what we found. The average minimum wage, when you to look at take into account state adjusted minimum wages, had risen by about a quarter over the past generation in real terms and in inflation adjusted terms. That reduced poverty. More children, slightly more children, are living in two-parent families. That reduces poverty. There was a sharp decline in teen births that had a big effect on deep poverty. So there's economic and demographic trends that, quite apart from anything the government did with the safety net, would have reduced child poverty. But of all the factors we looked at, the expansion of government aid was a dominant factor, probably the leading factor in reducing child poverty over the past generation.
So, how have those relief policies, the resources provided by the government, changed since the early 90s?
Right. So then you were saying it's not just one policy, it's a whole host of policies, and that's quite accurate. We looked at 10 major government programs. Eight were now having a larger anti-poverty impact than they had had a generation ago. Some are targeted only at working families. These are the so-called working tax credits, refundable tax credits, earned income tax credit, and the child tax credit through 2019. Those benefits only went to families who were working. So that's more aid for the working poor. But there were also expansions of other programs like SNAP, or what used to be called food stamps, and school meals, which go to all children, regardless of whether their parents are working. So it was a mix of policies, both targeted at the working poor, targeted at low-wage workers, and also targeted at all families.
Is it easier to qualify for this kind of help today than it was a generation ago?
I'm sorry, Chris, I think we had a glitch. I couldn't quite hear your question. Please,
I'm wondering,
say that again.
Yeah, if it's easier to qualify for certain kinds of government assistance today than it was a generation ago. Like you mentioned, school meals, those are provided in many school districts to every student, not just regardless of whether their parents are working, but every student regardless of income. I wonder how common something like that is.
Right. So in some programs, the benefit was actually increased, the earned income, like in the tax credit programs. The earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, those benefits were increased, like tripled in size over the course of the past generation, you know, from a couple $1,000s to $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year that you could get from those programs. In other areas, the benefits didn't really increase, but the eligibility expanded so that more people qualified for the same benefit. That would be the case in some of the school feeding programs. It's not that the program that the meals grew more valuable, it's just that more kids were able to get it. And in still other programs, it's just that red tape was reduced, so it became easier for families who did qualify previously to actually get the benefit. They didn't have to fill out as many forms, didn't have to fill them out as often. So there's lots of ways in which the safety net can become more valuable to families, some of which are, you know, obvious, raise the benefits, but in others it's just make them easier to use or cover a larger share of children.
How did the earned income tax credit manage to hand sizable annual cash payments to working parents without setting off those kind of moral hazard alarm bells that inevitably were set off by welfare?
Thanks for that good question. Let's talk about the earned income tax credit for a second, because it sounds so opaque and technocratic. You know, it sounds like something your accountant does for you and you don't really know what it is. We're really not talking about taxes. We're talking about an annual check that the government sends a working family. It's a wage supplement. Think of it as a bonus that goes to low wage workers. Once a year comes after they file the taxes, they may get $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 back for the government to do it as they wish. Your question was, why does that program retain substantial bipartisan support? And that's, I think, because it is targeted only on workers. If you, for whatever reason, do not work, you're unable to get it. It's a program to support people who work.
Jason, what do we know about how families are apt to use the money they receive from the earned income tax credit?
The earned income tax credit is something that I think most affluent or even middle class families have no idea about, but it's a big deal in low income life, like in the lives of low income families. When tax season comes around, furniture stores have sales, car lots have sales, people take this money and use it to pay off utility debts, they use it to buy cars, they use it to buy the kids' clothes, to take kids on vacations. It's become a foundation of life, for economic life, for low income families.
To the extent that the EITC seems to have, certainly been more popular on a bipartisan basis than welfare ever was, although it was a Democratic president that sort of put the end to welfare as we had known it. Has it proven true that welfare was a disincentive to working parents getting jobs? I mean,
a much debated topic. What happened was, in the mid 1990s, the government changed welfare laws and made it much harder to get cash assistance, and the share of low income single mothers who worked shot up substantially. There were other reasons for it growing besides the end of welfare. The economy was very strong, and the expansion, the simultaneous expansion of tax credits, made work more rewarding because you got this extra money back at the end of the year. So all three things were happening at once. As of about 2000, that growth in the share of women working, single mothers working, stopped, and it started to decline after that. So welfare laws may have been a small disincentive to working. I don't think there's been, I don't think the evidence would show that they were a large disincentive to working.
Everybody who's raised children knows that, they need to visit the doctor fairly often, not just for well-child checkups, but inevitably they get sick. How has access to health insurance expanded among U.S. families, and what do we know about coverage of children now?
Hey, thanks again for a great question. So, the share of kids without medical insurance has declined by about two-thirds over the past generation. That's a big decline, and that's a lot of extra kids who have health insurance. I reported from Huntington, West Virginia, and at a Head Start center there. So, low-income families, low-income kids. Essentially, all the kids had medical care. It just wasn't an issue the way it had been before. One of the families I talked to, the child was delayed a year in speaking. It turns out, they thought he might be autistic. It turned out he had a extra tissue under his tongue that was keeping his tongue from moving in the way he needed. And Medicaid paid for the operation, and problem solved. Another kid needed ear tubes. Same thing. Developmentally delayed in school. Got the ear tubes, problem solved. So that has had a profound impact on kids. And it's not captured in those poverty statistics because the census doesn't count, Census Bureau doesn't count it as income when you get health insurance. So, for the purposes of poverty, whether you have insurance or don't have insurance is irrelevant. It's a separate indicator, but another area of important progress.
We talked already about meals at school. Tell us how other food programs like SNAP have helped alleviate some amount of poverty and hunger for families with children.
SNAP was kind of reinvented after the welfare laws were toughened and became, I think, seen as by some political officials and administered by many state authorities, less as a welfare program and more as a support program for working parents. So lots of people who left the welfare rolls and went to jobs in low-wage service economy, caregivers, certified nursing assistants, fast food workers, drivers, clerical aides, people who are making $9, $10, $11 an hour. Lots of those families are getting food assistance from the SNAP program. And officials made a point of making it easier to use on the theory that these families were now busy at work. They couldn't go once a month and sit around the welfare office waiting to, get their benefits reauthorized. The program cut the red tape, and enrollment over the past generation, at one point had more than doubled.
You mentioned minimum wage earlier. The federal minimum wage has sat at $7.25 an hour for 13 years. $7.25 an hour is not enough for a family to live on, even with full-time employment pretty much anywhere in the country anymore. But states and even some cities have passed their own higher minimums. Are people using the fact that this may have contributed to a reduction in child poverty as an argument for a federal hike in the minimum wage?
Yeah, the Fed, over the court time we examined, which was almost three decades, the value of the federal minimum wage had actually declined. When adjusted for inflation, it was worth less in 2019 than it was worth in 1993. So the federal minimum wage has left low-income families in a worse position. But as you noted, there's been a major movement in states to increase their minimum wages. If you take the state level minimum wages, the average minimum wage nationwide has grown by about a quarter over the past generation, and that did have an effect on reducing poverty. It definitely lifted families out of poverty. There's a major movement to try to increase both the federal and the state minimum wages. Poverty reduction is certainly one of the reasons behind it. Yeah.
To the extent that what we have that has reduced child poverty in really remarkable ways still amounts to a sort of patchwork system rather than one-stop shopping, Is that a strength or a weakness?
The American safety net is criticized far more than it's lauded. You know, people complain about waste, they complain about abuse, they complain about the multiple programs that there's you know, three different programs in nutrition. There's SNAP, there's WIC, there's school meals, and there's multiple healthcare programs. There's multiple housing programs. It's easy to assail it as you said, a patchwork, complicated, difficult to use system that treats people kind of whimsically, you know, denies aid often to people who we think of being as deserving. All that said, I think what we found is that, you know, it protects a lot of people from poverty, and it protects a lot more people from poverty now than it did a generation ago. In 1993, again, the starting point for our examination, the safety net lifted only 9% of, protected 9% of children from poverty. Of all the children who would otherwise have been poor, it reduced the number by about 9%. And by 2019, they'd grown from 9% to 44%. So I'm sure there are better ways to devise a safety net. At the same time, I think it's important to look at, to recognize that the one we do have is doing a lot of good for a lot of people.
How well did this cobbled together safety net work during a crisis like the Great Recession?
Historically, when the economy gets worse, child poverty goes up. You know, it makes sense. People lose their jobs. They make or suffer a wage reduction. In the Great Recession, that didn't happen, counterintuitively. So the new safety net that had been fashioned in the 1990s did more to protect children during a time of a recession than past safety nets had done. That was one reason. And also Congress did pass some temporary aid in the Great Recession, as it, of course, it did in the pandemic. So over the past two major economic crises, the Great Recession of the mid-2000s and the pandemic, in both cases, the government did a lot to protect children from poverty, and poverty rates either stayed stable or actually declined.
I don't know if this is easy to parse out live on the radio, but how did Democrats and Republicans contribute different kinds of ideas to the safety net as it is structured today?
I think the dominant Republican fingerprints have been on efforts to reduce access to cash for people who don't work and increase rewards to those who do. So again, going back to the welfare and rolls, you know, they fell by about 80% as a result of the tougher laws, time limits, work requirements. You know, the number of women getting cash aid fell by about 80%. But at the same time, Republicans generally went along with tax credit expansions that paid low-wage workers these subsidies that come in annual grants. So the Republican contribution, I think, has been to push more people to work. The Democratic contribution has been to increase spending programs more broadly. So the healthcare expansions mostly came through Democratic policy, and the housing, to the extent the housing has been expanded, some of the nutrition programs have been expanded. Overall spending on poor children has more than doubled over the past generation. I think that's mostly due to Democratic policies.
Jason, Black and brown children in the United States have, I think, forever been at greater risk for poverty than their white counterparts. Is this still true?
It is, but so child poverty fell by almost 60% over the course of generation, and it fell equally among white children, Black children, Latino children, Asian children. That was one of the remarkable things that we found in the data, that child poverty fell in every state, and it fell equally among every ethnic and racial group. Now, that said, because historically, minority children had been so much more likely to be poor, the disparities continue to exist. And Black and Latino children are on average about three times more likely than white children to be poor. That remains the case. Yes, the gaps didn't narrow.
What about children living with undocumented parents? Are they more likely to live in poverty, even if they themselves are U.S. citizens and presumably qualify for all the kinds of assistance that we've been talking about?
Yeah, Chris. So I spend a lot of my time, you know, looking at poverty statistics and talking to people about poverty statistics. And in the course of this reporting, I've learned something that I hadn't previously known, which was that more than a fifth of all poor children in the United States have an undocumented parent. So more than 20% of our poor children have at least one undocumented parent. And that typically means that their families certainly can't get as much safety net help and often can't get any. So those kids, most of the kids are American citizens, but you know, we have a category of American citizen children who just don't have the same access to the safety net that other kids do have.
Has anybody proposed any kind of solution that could ameliorate at least some of that?
You know, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, the immigration politics are, the politics of illegal immigration are quite polarized, and any effort to make more children eligible for government programs, regardless of their parents' economic status, undocumented immigration status, that become an immigration debate, not a safety net debate. And I think we've seen how gridlocked the immigration debate is. So I don't foresee that happening in the immediate future.
How is the efficacy of any government aid or incentive program targeting, you know, economic welfare? How is that measured or tested?
That's a good question. And it depends on who's looking at it. So some people would say that the measure is poverty. You know, you want to reduce poverty by giving people more aid. If you look at the expanded child tax credit during the pandemic, we gave families with young children expanded checks, and it cut the child poverty rate a lot. So Democrats, progressives generally say, hey, that's efficacy. We provided more subsidies to families and reduced the poverty rate. I think conservatives would tend to look at whether people are working, and they also tend to be more concerned about family structure and whether we're shoring up the two-parent family. So I think they would put those two things, hours worked and family structure, rank those as least as important, if not more important, than the poverty rate itself. That's part of why we have policies aimed in such different directions.
What happens to government benefits for families that earn their way just a little above the official poverty line?
It depends on the program. Some wean out slowly, like the earned income tax credit goes far above the poverty line and declines slowly, so that there's not a, you know, it's not like if you earn an extra dollar, you lose all your benefits, which would be a disincentive to work. But some other programs do have, they're called in the technical debates, they're called cliffs. If you get an extra dollar, you know, you lose all your aid. That was one problem with the old welfare system. The child tax credit has none of that. You get it no matter how much you keep earning, you know, up to like $400,000. It really depends on the program. I'm sorry, there's not a simple answer to that.
In 1993, the sort of average fertility rate in the United States was 2.02 children. Now, as of 2019, the latest year for which figures were available, it's 1.7. Have smaller family sizes contributed to reductions in child poverty?
The poverty threshold is adjusted for family size. So that's kind of incorporated into the statistic. The more kids you have, the higher the poverty line would be. So not particularly.
It is very strange to talk about any kind of bright spot from COVID. But as you've mentioned, contrary to many people's fears, the pandemic did not drive a lot more families into poverty. What's happened to that extra aid that families were able to count on in the early months and year or so of the pandemic?
Well, for the families that we're talking about, low-income families with children, the big policy innovation during the pandemic was the expansion of the child tax credit. And again, we're talking about tax credit as though it's something a conversation we have with our accountants. But this was a program, again, that just delivers cash grants, and it did it on a monthly basis so that families with the youngest children, preschool children, would have got $300 a month per child. Others got $250 a month per child, and they got it every month, just a cash supplement. That was a one-time, that cut the child poverty rate nearly in half. It was one-time aid, lasted a year, it's expired. President Biden wants to bring it back. The Republicans unanimously oppose it as a form of welfare.
So are proponents of expanding aid more permanently thinking that this at least demonstrates it's possible if we were to keep programs like this going?
Absolutely. So you asked me earlier, you know, how do you judge the efficacy of a social program? The proponents, the progressives, President Biden said the efficacy of this program is clear. It immediately cut child poverty nearly in half. And conservatives say, well, that's no achievement. What you want to do is push people to work more and rise out of poverty on their own. And there, the evidence of whether the child tax credit can do that is weaker.
I mean, the folks,
depends on what your values are. Do you value, yeah, you know, which do you value more? Reducing child poverty or increasing the number of hours that people work?
Could the federal government afford to keep up COVID-era levels of child tax credits without driving the tax rates up for folks who don't get this kind of assistance?
It would cost about $120 billion a year to make permanent what we did during the pandemic. That's not a small expenditure by any amount, but it's less than we spent on the tax cuts that President Trump and the Republicans pushed through in 2017. So it's we said we could afford to cut taxes much more then. It's certainly within the realm of other things the government does.
One thing that may be vexing to people who think this is a good idea is that the long-term benefits of this, I mean, they're going to take a while to manifest themselves, right? You can say you're reducing poverty today, which is amazing, but you may not see the society-wide benefits for another 15 or 20 years.
You asked, can we afford to do this right? So some people would say we can't afford not to do it, that you reap long-term savings in health programs, you reach long-term savings by having people grow up to earn more money and pay more in taxes and reduce prison costs. The National Academy of Sciences, a very distinguished academic group, estimated the annual cost of child poverty of being upwards of $800 billion a year.
There are plenty of people who don't have children or whose children are grown and gone that are living in poverty. What do the numbers look like for these folks since the 90s?
So for historically, the children in America were much more likely to be poor than the elderly. By historically, I mean, you know, since the 60s or so, over the past four or five decades. And that was often seen by policy analysts as being an upside down situation that you want to invest in your future, that kids, you know, what happens to kids, as we were saying earlier, stays with them for life, that you really needed to reduce the child poverty rate. Just in the past year or so, those rates have flipped. So now, actually, the elderly are slightly more likely than children to be poor. Not because the number of elderly who are poor has gone up, but because child poverty has come down so much.
What kind of assistance is available to people who are maybe trying to work but are not able to get enough work or aren't able to earn enough money. Are you just sort of out of luck in this country if you don't have kids?
Oh, if you don't have kids, I'm sorry. I was about to say, oh no, not on the on the contrary, not at all. But a lot of our I wouldn't go as far as saying out of luck, but certainly the major support programs and the tax credit stuff that we've been talking about, which again, $7,000-$8,000 a year between the two tax credits that a low income family could get, those are only available to families that work. I'm sorry, there's a very small part of the EITC that workers without children can get, but by and large, our aid has been targeted on children.
And how do we compare now in child poverty to other developed countries around the world?
Still not good. I saw something recently. I think we ranked 36 out of 41 among advanced nations in terms of the share of our kids in poverty. There are measurement issues, and it depends a little bit how you measure. But the United States continues to lag most other wealthy nations.
It's harder in this country to get housing assistance than it is in a lot of other places, isn't it?
Some programs, if you qualify, you get it automatically, like Social Security or Medicaid, for that matter. It doesn't matter how much the program's spending. Congress just guarantees it'll come up with the money and you get the benefit. Housing's not that way. In housing, they basically give out the housing assistance until it runs out and then everybody else goes on the waiting list. And it's very common for those waiting lists to be 5, 6, 7 years long. So only about a quarter of the people in the country who qualify economically for housing assistance actually get it.
Were there things that people who follow this as part of their careers said to you about the changes that have happened in the last 3 decades that surprised you?
You know what surprised me was the families that that I talked to, the low income families, how much the tax credits that they get annually, how important that is in their overall annual budget. I mean, they count on that. They run up debts during the year that they pay down with that money. They count on that to get their kids' school supplies. They count on that for the annual clothing trip. They count on that, you know, to do vehicle maintenance. Those tax credits over the past generation, that $5,000-$7,000 annual bonus is just deeply woven into the survival strategies of low-income families.
Did families also tell you, I mean, do these programs help them feel better about the job they're doing raising their own kids? Sometimes, you know, so many people work full time, but they work full time at a job that just doesn't pay very much, and it can be hard to provide everything kids need.
Absolutely. So the reason we have these programs is because, you know, the jobs pay so little. I was in, again, Huntington, West Virginia. That one woman I talked to had been on the same job. She was a nursing aide for 13 years. She was only up to like $12 an hour. So she was still getting, in her case, housing assistance. She was getting food stamps, and she was getting these tax credits. I mean, these, again, are people who are full-time annual workers. These are not. So you were asking, how do they feel about it? I don't think they think about it as "quote unquote welfare." They think about it as they're due for their for working hard, and it gives them. You're asking how they feel about it. It gives them. They feel like good parents because they can invest the money in music lessons, in sports leagues, in new clothes, in a trip to the amusement park for the kids. It helps them feel like they're doing a good job raising their kids.
So we've seen these really amazing reductions in poverty rates, Jason. We've also seen inflation rates creeping up. I mean, I have sufficient income that I can afford to pay for food even as prices rise. But I think of myself as a young parent when it was just me, and I really would have felt that. Are people worried that inflation will cause a backslide?
Yes, and I do think there's some evidence already that as pandemic aid has ended, there's been some rise in hardship. Sure. Again, I'm trying to keep two thoughts in mind equally. One is that we've made a lot of progress over the past generation, that all the money we pay for these programs does have a beneficial effect on people's lives. And at the same time, I don't want to leave the impression that our workers' work is done or that we've ended hardship in America. Come back to it one more time. There are 8 million kids still in poverty in this country, and many more who aren't officially in poverty, that aren't reaching their full potential because they lack the resources to do so. So, to me, what this progress shows is that progress is possible on an issue that once seemed intractable. Ronald Reagan once famously said, "We fought a war on poverty, and poverty won." I don't think we can say that anymore. I don't think poverty won.
Have you talked to children living in poverty or near poverty about their perception of their lives compared to their peers at school and how it affects them emotionally?
Yes, I have, and I think it's an issue that probably developmentally, I think it's harder on kids when they're youngest, but I think they become more aware of it the older they get. So I don't usually hear 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds or 9-year-olds thinking of themselves as poor. I do hear that among 14 or 15-year-olds. I hear them talking about themselves as excluded or stigmatized or embarrassed, or because they don't have the right clothes or the right, or because they have to pay for school meals. One kid I interviewed in Louisiana was a played on the football team, and his mother couldn't afford to come in the ticket to come watch him in the stadium, so she would sit in the parking lot in the car and listen to the game on the radio to try to support him.
I guess we'd be remiss without bringing this up, Jason. Is anybody talking about an obligation that employers might have to a moral obligation, an ethical obligation, to pay their workers enough that they are not trying to raise kids in poverty?
Oh, all the time. And there are some progressives who don't like the tax credits for that reason. They think they let big employers sort of off the hook because the government's in effect paying a wage subsidy. There are often studies done of the share of Walmart workers or other big retailers that make low wages, of how what share get Medicaid or SNAP, or what how many billions of government dollars go into the subsidizing the low wage workforce. That's a definitely a critique that you'll hear.
That's interesting because that subsidy works twice, right? It works for those workers so that they can survive. It also ultimately benefits probably wealthy shareholders.
It's yes, it's if the government wasn't providing that aid to the workforce, that's the argument that the employers themselves would have to do so.
Jason DeParle is senior writer at the New York Times, where he wrote recently about the drop in child and overall U.S. poverty driven by the expansion of safety net programs and other factors. Jason, I really appreciate your reporting on this and the fact that you were able to make time for us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your good questions. Enjoyed it.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and sign up. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.